Welcome to Plastic Model Mojo, a podcast dedicated to scale modeling, as well as the news and events around the hobby. Let's join Mike and Kentucky Dave as they strive to be informative, entertaining, and help you keep your modeling mojo alive.
Listeners, it's the triple one, Dave.
Yep.
111.
111. Did you ever think?
Once we got to 100, I thought the sky's the limit, but before then, probably not. I didn't know. I was hopeful.
Yep.
And we made it.
We did indeed.
Well, folks, it's March in Kentucky. Spring's trying to pop out today for sure.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of nice. Modeling weather's going to get away from us, Dave. Hope we've been busy.
Yep.
Well, speaking of busy, what's been up in your model sphere?
Well, I got to tell you, I am stoked. Everything modeling adjacent is coming up roses. First of all, we're back into contest season. You and I attended the show at Columbus, white-knuckled it up there through the blizzard. Had a great time. There is nothing better than spending all day Saturday hanging around with other modelers, looking at models and buying kits that you probably don't need, but still. I'm stoked because we're 2 months into 2024 on the Plastic Model Mojo, and the first four episodes have been bangers. And I think the two that we have for March, this one and the next, are slated to be great as well. I'm stoked because you and I have a lot of plans for 2024 for Plastic Model Mojo, and all of the modeling adjacent stuff is falling into place. And, you know, you get the juices flowing, you kind of feel it. It's kind of like spring. I mean, that first day you walk out and it's warm and sunny, and it just changes your whole attitude. And I'm there for it. How about you?
Well, of course, I was at the show as well. And I won't rehash everything you said, but it got me fired up, I'll tell you that.
Yes, it did.
That usually happens. So I'm looking forward to how that impacts me going forward. And folks will hear some of that in the Benchtop Halftime Report, because I had a pretty good Saturday.
Yes, you did.
But in the model sphere, kind of modeling adjacent stuff, I finally got my LED upgrade, lighting upgrade in my spray booth.
All right.
And it went pretty well. Most of our EE team is down at the Marshall Space Flight Center this week, taking care of some testing. And the lab EE lab tech looked not so busy today, so I imposed on him to make a few changes to the light strips I needed to fit them into my spray booth, and he knocked that out for me.
Nice.
I like the upgrade. I never thought sunscreen was going to be part of my airbrush protocol, but I might need to drop a tube of 50 SPF down the supply drawer. Future's bright, man. I got to wear shades.
That's right. There's a musical reference that even I got.
Seriously, though, I shopped around. I found some that were the right color temperature and had the right color rendering index, which is what you got to do.
Did you previously post on the dojo what you got?
I know I sent it to someone.
You did, because they asked. But
and I don't know if I ever put it on the dojo. Maybe I should.
Yes, you should. Do me a favor. Put that on the dojo, because I think a lot of people, me included, would be interested to see exactly what you procured.
In short, until I get there, it was about a meter long, four row wide strip light. So a lot of lights.
Yeah.
And had to cut it into two segments and bridge the wiring and do a couple other things to it. Well, the lab tech did it for me. And, you know, I found the right ones, and to find what I wanted, and folks are interested in using this kind of lighting or any kind of lighting on their workbench or in their spray booth, what have you. Scale Model Workshop, Paul Budzik, has got a review of a task lamp in his video catalog on his YouTube channel, Model Workshop.
I remember that one.
And he goes into color temperature and the color rendering index and how the CRI is actually the most important one. And yeah, so you can use that information to go shopping for lights and get the right ones. And yeah, it all works out. So really pleased. I'm getting excited for my next spray session.
Well, good.
Because now I can see what I'm doing. Well, that's about it.
Good. Since we're recording, it's episode 111. What modeling fluid do you have?
Oh, I might have squirreled back one more night's worth of that Pursuit bourbon.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
That stuff is so sweet.
Yeah, it's good, so.
Well, I don't blame you for doing that.
So that's what I'm on to. What about you?
Well, I am trying something new for me, and this could be good, could be bad. We'll see. New Belgium Hop Avenger IPA. It's from New Belgium, 7% alcohol by volume. Have never had it before, and generally have steered away from things that advertise themselves as hoppy. But hang on. Oh, that's not bad at all. This is going to get me through the episode. We'll talk at the end, but yeah, I think this one's going to turn out to have been a good choice.
Had to throw a picture of the can up on the
on the
Facebook group so we can see what you're going on there. Of course, there'll be a link in the show notes as well.
Oh, there will with that as well.
Well, the listener mail did not disappoint over the last couple of weeks.
Never does.
And we got some new folks in here too.
Good.
We don't mind the regulars writing in a lot, but you know, it's nice to have some fresh names in the mix, and we do.
Yep.
Up first, Pat Cownan from Kiefer, Oklahoma, and he wants to show his appreciation for my Andy Griffith Show reference.
Okay.
He's a fan too, so best show ever.
Oh, it's a great show.
That's my opinion, and apparently his too. So, Pat, thank you for that, and don't end up in a citizen's arrest.
There you go. Don't make Barney pull the bullet out of his pocket.
Well, Special Agent 003 Brandon Jacob has written in, and I'm going to spare you this one and just send it to you. But he wants to call you out on your unwillingness to discuss your model building hobby with your coworkers.
Uh-oh. Well, you know, all I've got to say is Brandon and his abandoned fishing boat on the dojo are just some of my favorite modeling out there. So I'll take a hit from Brandon.
Up next, Artie Maud from Surrey, England.
All right.
Telling us that the Wheel of Accidental Wisdom reveals why he enjoys the podcast so much, and he really liked it. He also mentions that particular question on the wheel. He's a little nicer than Brandon, though. Evan and I are more comfortable in our engineering environments talking about such things. So,
yes, I think that's probably true, and I think that at least part of that has to do with engineering as opposed to law. Although, again, lawyers are overrepresented in modeling. It is amazing how many lawyers are modelers.
You might be surprised.
Yep.
Well, he wants to comment on your statement about only having 10 to 15 years of modeling left. Can this really be true? Could the hobby prolong your life alongside a healthy diet and exercise?
It probably could. And I think it probably could keep you mentally sharp. And Lord knows I've got the genes for it. My parents and grandparents have all lived exceptionally long lives. But, you know, I'll take any bonus years I get, but I'm really, as part of my motivation to get stuff that I want to do done now, I've got to at least be realistic with myself that it could be as little as 10 to 15 years left. So we'll see.
Well, I hope not.
I do too, but.
Get some exercise, man.
There you go.
Quit eating too late at night.
Well, those are two of the many bad things that I do.
Then you won't need as much exercise.
There you go.
Our friend Thomas Karen from Utah has written in again. And again, like the Wheel of Accidental Wisdom, he wanted to comment on the wheel question we had about losing parts.
Yeah.
And something we didn't mention. In fact, another person also wrote in with this same thing, which is kind of funny. We'll get to that in a minute. But he had a part fly off through the air, watched it land a couple feet away, kept his eye on it the whole time. And as soon as it hit the ground, his dog rushed over and ate it.
Oh, man.
I've not had that happen, but
I have not had that happen. But then again, none of the menagerie of pets in our house are allowed into the basement, much less into the model room.
Well, I've got a golden retriever, and it doesn't decide its food until it's already in its mouth and decides it's going to spit it out or not.
Yep.
She's gonna latch on as soon as it hits the ground if she's close.
Yep.
Because it might be something
good.
That's
a golden for you.
Might be bacon.
Yeah, might be. You never know.
Well, Tom wants to shout out. Tom wants to shout out Michael Karnauka. He looks forward to his post in the dojo. Some of those interesting and crazy things he's been posting in there.
Yes.
And he also wants to shout out Martin Drayton. And I think we do too, but
yes.
We'll get to our reason in a second. Says he's such a talented artist. And even though he's from the UK, he's a fellow Utahan. So there you go. Shout out from a fellow Utahan. Most folks may know if they're on the Facebooks, Mr. Drayton had a unfortunate snowboarding accident. He was run over by a runaway skier and suffered some injury, and he's waylaid for a little while. Hopefully we'll see a lot of modeling out of him, but I want to wish Martin the best and speedy recovery. And yeah, I hope that guy's having a guilty conscience, because that's really crappy, man.
Yeah, especially not stopping. Yeah. Martin, we're thinking about you. And hopefully, again, it'll give you more time to post your great modeling in the dojo. But I hope you make a very speedy recovery.
Up next, we jet off to another corner of the world. This email is from Ville Yrvanen. And Ville is from Amiinlinna, Finland. And he's mostly a car builder.
Mm-hmm.
And he agrees with us. You can cross-pollinate and pull some skills and learning from all the different genres. I will say that cars are a topic we intend on hitting here, hopefully not too distant future.
Yeah.
So Ville, we'll hopefully have a car centric episode coming up here, hopefully before too long. We got a busy schedule, man, but we're going to get that in somewhere. And he says, we've talked about car modeling being a little different. And I think we came to our own conclusion or opinion that it's probably a lot of people who are into car models are actually into real cars as well.
Yes.
And some of that kind of show car kind of thing kind of spills into their modeling, which is fine. I just think that it makes it, at least to us who don't do cars, makes it seem a little different. And he says, some modelers do make models with historical references, but others like to modify and customize their cars just like their one-to-one rides. Well, yep. There he just said it, right?
Yep, exactly.
Their one-to-one rides. What do you think of the philosophy of imaginary builds? Could you build one? Well, that's kind of a broad question. Now I'm going to think he means something completely imaginary, not
right. Non-prototype,
not like, well, not even like generic markings on a historical aircraft or armor, right? Used to be done a lot. Now it's not done quite as much. I don't think, maybe it is. I don't know. Yeah, I think I could, I don't know what it would be. You know, Jeff Groves, inch high guy there. He did that,
XB38.
Yeah.
Plus
that's imaginary.
Yep.
What about you?
You know what? I think that it's quite possible that something could strike me that I'd want to do that, something like that. But I will tell you that in general, I think that I've got my queue is so backed up with things that are, models of real items that I could do it. I'm not sure I'll get around to doing it.
You know, one thing I've always thought about, and one of our club members has done this, if I'm not mistaken. I used to draw, you know, I grew up Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica, all that. And
yep.
When I was bored, I'd, you know, kids draw, right?
Yep.
And I'd draw these big freaking Star Cruiser battleship things. And God, was the space battleship Yamato was on TV and all that kind of thing with all the little jet fighters or space fighters flying around. I've always wondered about building one of those from scratch, kind of like a movie model.
Yeah.
Something like that has been an idea in my head. I don't know. Again, like you, I don't know that's something I would ever do, but thank you, Ville from Finland. He's also got a question for the wheel. We'll save that because we need to repopulate the wheel.
Yes, we do.
Up next, Don Gilman from College Station, Texas. He's a repeat offender, but he's back again. This is what I was alluding to earlier. Keep the dog and cat out of the model shop. I know my last dog, a Shetland sheepdog, had caught parts in the past in her fur.
Oh, man.
That's a little different than eating it, but the dog could be up and gone before you even realize that's what happened.
Yep. Yep. Nope. I have a hard and fast rule. The pets don't get into the basement, much less into the model room.
He also had a new house, new shop, and added trim strips to the bottom of the desk to seal it off from bouncing parts and the hutch on the desk. Same thing there.
Smart move.
And close any drawers in or adjacent to the desk when doing small parts.
Yep. It's a good idea.
He's found parts nestled alongside his Tamiya paint in the drawer every now and then.
Yep.
And he also would like to make an episode suggestion.
All right. We're always open to that.
So we appreciate that. Again, I don't like broadcasting those because sometimes when I do that, we're the second podcast to have that show topic. Kevin White from Mississauga, Canada. He's from IPMS London, which is Stuart Clark's club.
Yep.
Maybe we'll see him at Heritage Con.
I would think so. You'd be crazy to be that close and not go.
Well, he brings back episode 107, and Mr. Karnauka had asked a question about a TV show about scale modeling, right?
Right.
Some facet about it. I think he asked, what if we could do it, what would it be? I think that was the theme of it. Kevin says that there is a YouTuber named Max Konke, or Konke. It's a German name, but this gentleman may be German. Maybe he's not. I don't know. Anyway, the channel's called Max's Models, MaxsModels, one word, Max's Models. And he has a series of videos detailing the rise and fall, if they've fallen, of most of the major kit brands, everything from Aurora to Wingnut Wings.
Hmm.
So I'm going to have to check these out because Kevin says Max is also an engaging speaking guest. He's spoken at the IPMS Toronto Club a while back when they were doing their Zoom meetings and provide a lot of interesting details about the hobby history. So we need to check that out.
Definitely.
He's got a YouTube link here, and we'll put that in the show notes so everybody else can check it out too. And finally, Dave, from the email side of things from New York City, whose name's come up twice already, Mr. Michael Karnauka. And of course, he's got a question.
All right.
You're going to like this one. He's wondering if either of us have ordered and prepared an aftermarket item for use. And as you went to install it into the model, you noticed the original plastic part was as good or better detailed or not worth the hassle than the replacement parts.
The answer to this question is yes. And I maintain that in many respects, especially in, say, the Edouard Big Ed sets and things like that, some of the items that they produce in photo etch that they want you to use to replace the plastic item, either the kit part or a molded on piece on the model, are not any qualitative improvement over the part in many cases. So the answer to that question is yes, particularly when it comes to photo etch.
I've got one. Yeah. It's when I was building the Allen SU-76, the first aftermarket that came out with that was the Edwards set, which you know, back in the early days, before they were even making kits, you know, this is a long time ago. And the ammo racks in that photo etch set were just folded up or sheet metal, photo etch metal versions of the kit parts, which weren't even remotely correct. So
all they had done is taken the kit part, turned it into photo etch, and reproduced it without any care about whether it was actually accurate.
Well, they went ahead and added, you know, the round seats in the bottom for the ends of the rounds and the clips to hold the tops of the rounds. But still, the basic form factor of the thing was just this box shape that was not what the real one. I mean, it wasn't even remotely close.
Yeah.
It's complete figment of some kit designer's imagination at Allen Hobbies or some poorly restored monument tank somewhere. I don't know how they got there, but you know, I ended up having to scratch build the things. That was fun, but That's an example of one that was not any better. It was just a dead swap, essentially.
Right.
Now, I'm going to deviate just a little bit and add another one that's sometimes, I don't think it's ever happened to me, but one time. So this is a deep track. So this is going okay. Way back again. Way even more so than the Allen SU-76. Back in my earlier modeling days, late 80s, early 90s, the aftermarket thing was just kind of new. Mm-hmm. And VLS Corporation was just coming on, importing some of this really esoteric stuff like Schmidt Vacuform kits.
Oh, yeah. Schmidt Model Bow.
So they were doing all these self-propelled gun conversions on German tanks. There weren't any kits of at the time. And I had a few of them. I've built a couple of them. And for the time, it was a decent place to start a lot of times. Saved you some time. Not a lot. I always had wanted to do, during that time, I was wanting to do a Hummel, you know, the 150 millimeter right. self-propelled gun based on the Panzer III, IV extended chassis. And Schmidt made one. No, I've got this backwards. They did make one, but let me back up a little further. Another aftermarket company who had never ordered from up at this point, out in Colorado, called AEF Designs.
Yes.
Advertised a Hummel conversion kit. So I ordered it, and months and months and months later it came.
Right.
And it was this box of unusable crap, essentially. It was just, you're going to have to fix so much on it, you might as well scratch build it.
Right.
So, okay, lesson learned, maybe, sort of. So then Schmidt shows one, and VLS shows a Schmidt one in their catalog. It's like a year later, maybe.
Yep.
So I order it, and I get it in, and it's really interesting. There's like some design and nuances and some mold flaws and things in that start to look familiar.
And I know where this is going.
As it turns out, the AEF kit was a resin copy of the Schmidt kit. And you could just tell which one came first.
Right.
Right. So those guys had got the Schmidt kit, cut out all the parts, sanded them to shape, and then made resin molds of them.
Yep.
And it was just looked like the exact same thing. So they're never built either one of them, but still don't have a Hummel, but yeah.
You waited long enough. There are lots of good Hummel kits out there.
And now I don't have the interest I had in it.
Yeah, well, it'll come back around.
Well, Dave, that is all from the email side of things. What's been happening on the messages?
Well, we've been getting DMs, but I actually want to change it up a little bit. I'll mention a couple of DMs next episode that normally I would have mentioned here. But here, instead of talking about DMs, I want to talk about the dojo and the Facebook interactions from the dojo. And the reason I want to talk about this is that when you and I were white-knuckling it up to Columbus while we were trying to avoid getting into an accident, we were talking about all of the modeling channels on YouTube and how many modeling channels there were and how, you know, new ones popped up because of the fact that the more of them you watch, the algorithm searches for other channels of a similar nature. And so you're constantly getting new YouTube modeling channels. And we were kind of talking about, you know, I wonder how many there are, the variation in all of them. Well, that started kind of a interest in me to just select a random YouTube modeling video that popped up in my feed and watch it and then post on it in the dojo and invite people, you know, and I would note different things, production quality, music, no music, closed captions, English narration, just all sorts of stuff. And length, short video, long video, technique video versus kit review video. And it stimulated a really good set of discussions around those posts to what people were watching, what they preferred, what they didn't like. And it's really fascinating to see everybody commenting on all of these different things. And it kind of makes the point that I want to emphasize to the folks out there, if you're on Facebook and you're not a member of the dojo, you're missing out on some really, really good modeling conversation. I was really taken aback by the quality of the comments to these posts, the thought that people had given them. You know, some people had seen a particular channel before, some of them hadn't. Some of them expressed things that I hadn't noticed when I watched the video. It's just a really thought-provoking discussion. And just like we say, if you're not going to model contests, even if you don't enter, you're missing out on a lot of the good social interaction and everything else. Same thing applies to the dojo. If you're not on Facebook or not on the dojo, but are on Facebook, but you're missing out on some really good thought-provoking discussions about different aspects of modeling. And it's well worth doing. So if you're out there and you're not on the dojo, get on the dojo. If you're on the dojo, please post. It really, really does add to my enjoyment and everybody else's enjoyment and can add a lot to your modeling.
Is that all you got?
That's it, man.
Well, folks, if you want to write into the show, and we hope you do, please do. We love this segment. It's one of our favorites. It's my favorite, absolutely, I think.
Yep.
You can do so by writing plasticmodelmojo@gmail.com, or you can send a Facebook message through the instant messaging system on Facebook. So look forward to hearing from you.
If you're listening to this episode, we assume you like listening to Plastic Model Mojo. Do us a favor. When you're done listening, don't go to the podcasting app, Apple Podcasts or whatever podcasting app you use. Rate the podcast. Give it 5 stars. It helps drive the visibility of the podcast. Also, please, if you listen and you know a modeler who doesn't listen, either to podcasts generally or this podcast, please encourage them. Show them how to locate a podcast and how to listen to it. It is the number one way that we get new listeners. And Mike and I are really making an effort to make the podcast more visible to more people, because the more people who listen, the more people who participate, the more enjoyment we're all going to get out of this.
And after you've done that, please check out the other podcasts out in the model sphere. You can do so by going to www.modelpodcasts.com. That's model podcast plural. It's a consortium website set up with the help of Stuart Clark at the Scale Model Podcast up in Canada, who we're going to see at HeritageCon, I hope.
Yes.
You can go to that website, and there's banner links to all the podcasts who are participating in this spirit of cross promotion. In addition to the podcast, there's a lot of content creators out there who we've gotten to be pretty good friends with over the 4 years and change we've done this podcast. We've already mentioned Jeff Groves, The Inch High Guy. Please check out his blog, All Things 72nd Scale, The Inch High Guy. Chris Wallace, Model Airplane Maker, got a great blog and a great YouTube channel. Want to check that out? Sprue Pie with Frets, Mr. Stephen Lee, another great blog, long and short form content, always something going on, almost daily posts there, always got something good to say and interesting to read. Jim Bates, Scale Canadian TV, check out what Muffin and Jim are up to there on the YouTube. And finally, Panzermeister 36, or Panzermeister Models, I think he's trying to rebrand a little bit. Check out Evan McCallum's videos on YouTube as well.
If you are not a member of your national IPMS chapter, IPMS UK, the original IPMS, IPMS USA, IPMS Canada, IPMS Mexico, whatever, please consider joining. These are groups that are filled with volunteers who are giving up a little bit of their modeling time to give you a better modeling experience. Please join. Also, if you're an armor modeler and you're not a member of AMPS, the Armor Modeling Preservation Society, please consider joining AMPS. They're a great organization dedicated to making armor modeling more visible and better.
Well, Dave, let's have a word from our sponsor.
Plastic Model Mojo is now brought to you by Model Paint Solutions, your source for Harder Steenbeck airbrushes, David Union power tools, and laboratory-grade mixing, measuring, and storage tools for use with all your model paints, be they acrylic, enamels, or lacquers. Check them out at www.modelpaintsolutions.com.
Well, Dave, it's time for our special segment, and this time we're going to venture into a space we've not ever gone into.
Yep, this was completely... Well, not completely, because I go to Wonderfest and I've seen some of this type of work, but largely opaque to me before we got to this.
Well, it's the weird, scary, and monstrous side of modeling. If folks are IPMS USA members and got a recent journal, there was a build in there from Mr. Mark McGovern, and he's into all this kooky, zany, scary, spooky kind of Aurora monsters, all that kind of modeling genre, which is one that doesn't get a lot of attention, at least not in the general modeling public, from the historical side, I think. And the builds were Monogram's old Freddy Flypogger kits, which are in the vein of the Big Daddy Roth Rat Fink and the Hawk Weirdos.
Yep.
And they were built to an incredible high fidelity that is one. Sometimes you just see something and you go, huh, I never thought of that. And it was just, it really impressed me. So we reached out to Mark and he agreed to come on the show and talk about what he's got going on for a little bit. And let's get into that. Well, Dave, sometimes you just see something that kind of pushes you back or makes you cock your head a little bit and think, wow, what is that? And for me this month, it came with the current issue of the IPMS Journal and the Freddy Flypogger builds in there by Mr. Mark McGovern, who is our guest tonight. And Mark, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you joining us. I tell you, this is kind of the first time in Plastic Model Mojo history that I've kind of seen something that I had not a whole lot of familiarity with that made me basically just say, damn, that's pretty awesome. And it was your Freddy Flypogger builds in the IPMS Journal. Now, we'll put some pictures up so the listeners can see what we're talking about. But basically, these were old Monogram kits in the mid-60s, I think, and my impression was I was impressed. Let's put it that way. I was impressed. And Mark, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your modeling background?
Okay. Well, I'm a good son of the Great Lakes region. And when I was 8 years old, my birthday's in March. And when I was 8 years old, my father gave me an Aurora B26 Martin Murata, the 1/48 scale. And at the time, I thought, oh, this is okay, and wasn't overly impressed. I can't say that I even recall finishing the model. But then in Christmas that year, the neighbors gave my brother Frank the Aurora Frankenstein, and I got the Aurora Mummy. And that just blew my mind. I was just immediately captivated by building monster models. And long story short, I've been at it for the last ensuing 61 years. So that's how I got into it. You know, like a lot of people, it was a dear old dad that got me started and stuck with it. In early 2000, early 2000s, I was approached by Modelers Resource Magazine to do an article. They were doing a series on models that time forgot. And I think the first one that I submitted was Alfred E. Newman. And I ended up doing several articles for them. Then, you know, I was a member of the IPMS, and I started submitting articles to the IPMS. And along the way, yeah, you know, I'm doing pretty well at the in the competitions and the contests and so on. And eventually you put up a website, and that garnered people who asked me to build models on commission for them. And the fly poggers are part of the result of that. Mr. Mike Blanchard. Mike Blanchard is a collector extraordinaire, and he's has a place called The Core in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and it's a big comic book place, so that's where he's from. And he asked if I would do Freddy Flypogger as Super Fuzz first. And looking at that model when it came, it has the clear dome on it, so I said, we have to put a light in there. And he pretty much liked my sensibilities for what I wanted to do with a model, and that eventually brought the other two in, and several others, from him. But he likes my style, and I'm not sure what that style is exactly, but people seem to recognize it. So okay,
Let me ask you something. Let me take you back to 8-year-old you.
Yeah.
You get an Aurora B-26, and okay, that's all right. But then you get a mummy, and your brother gets a Frankenstein, and suddenly the light goes on, and you're off to the races. Were you, as a kid, did you like monster movies? What was it about that subject?
The year before, so this is 1962, the kid that lived across the street got a Dracula for Christmas. And I remember being mesmerized by James Bama's box art for that. And I really wanted to see what was in that box. And I remember everybody saying, it's like a puzzle, and you don't want to mess with it. It's too old for you. Okay. And it was later on, it dawned on me after I found out that there were more monster models besides Frankenstein and the mummy, that's what that was. And it's like, well, oh, good. Now I'm 8 years old. I'm old enough. I can do these. And long story short, I've been captivated by building horror figures ever since. Back then, I was smack dab in the middle of the monster craze. I'm reading Famous Monsters of Filmland, and I'm getting pretty much every monster model there was, the fakes and the weirdos and stuff. But also, I built the odd aircraft. I did like World War I airplanes. And once in a while, somebody give me a tank or something, and I go, okay, sure, And of course, Aurora came out with all those tie-in models, the Green Hornet and James Bond and 2001 and all that. So I had a steady diet, thanks to them, pretty much all my life.
What did you do when the drought hit in the, I guess it probably would have been late 70s, early 80s, when the Aurora stuff went away, the Rat Fink stuff pretty much. I mean, there was a period there where all of this type of stuff, nobody was doing it anymore for at least a small period of time. How did you survive?
That's true. Well, there was, they would reissue some of the monster figures. Of course, you already have them, right? But, I recall I was building, you'd still be able to find the repops of, like the flying sub from Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and things like that. So it got sparse.
I built that kit.
Yeah. I've got, it's one of the dozens that are in my stash. And so they never really disappeared it entirely. Of course, you had the monster scenes that came out and so on in the early 70s. And I don't know, somehow I limped along. And always had something on the shelf, something to build. I think it was through Revell, they had some European sci-fi kits, like the Perry Rodan and thing. I think that I had a couple of those, and so there was always something to slap together.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to the Freddy Flypogger kits, and let's set this up as why don't you tell our listeners what those are, the history behind them, and then how you got into that commission build, and then we'll talk about the actual build.
Okay, so like I say, Mike Blanchard, my client, he's a nice guy we've met, and he approached me about building Freddy Flypogger, and I wasn't really sure what they were, and there are plenty of reference books, you can look them up, and then, of course the internet, and so I come to find out that they were designed by a guy named Stanley Mouse Miller, who was in the same ballpark as Ed Roth, where these guys would go to car shows and stuff, and either design cars or do drawings of cars. And there was that bug-eyed, toothy monster in a motor vehicle sensibility that came out of the West Coast, and Stanley Miller had his. And his own version of those things. And we created this character called Freddy Flypogger. And somewhere along the line, Monogram Models in 1965, Monogram Models decided that they wanted to do a line of monster figures based on the designs of Stanley Miller. And so they did the Freddy Flypogger. They had Super Fuzz, which was the one that Mike first approached me about. And then Speed Shift, which was Fred riding on basically the transaxle of what had once been a car and is now just a pair of wheels. And then what was the other one? Flip Out. And Flip Out was a beach bum standing with a surfboard. And we discussed what he wanted to have his models look like, and he was aware of what my style was. That my take is always to try to build, first of all, to competition standards. So the paint job has to be smooth. There are supposed to be no seams or anything if they're not supposed to be there. And then on top of that, I want the model to look as realistic as possible, that if even as Freddy Flypogger, instead of painting him in wild colors and whatnot, I wanted to make it look like this bizarre living thing on the road. And so with the first one, there was a plastic dome on top of this helmet. It's Super Fuzz. He's a caricature of a cop in a hot rod. And when I first saw that dome, I said, "Oh, we got to put a flasher in there." And there's a company called Police Car Models that has just that sort of nice little LED setup, where you get the LED that flashes and a battery pack and a switch, and it's very inexpensive. And the only challenge was mounting that light up in the guy's helmet, running it through the body, and then hiding the battery pack someplace in the base. And to do that, the kit comes with simulated rooster tail of smoke and dust coming out the back. So I glued that onto a wood craft plaque, and the craft plaque is thick enough that I could hollow out a space for the battery pack, and then conceal the wiring and everything with a little bit of extra painted cotton smoke coming out the back of the car. And along the way, I covered the surface of the craft plaque with, I think it was like 150 grit sandpaper sprayed black to look like tar. And all of the things that it takes to make that look like a road. You put white glue tar repair strips on it and so on, and dirt and little bits of groundwork around the outside. I painted the yellow line so that it looks like he's driving over, things like that. And then for the rest, it was just trying to paint it and make it look as real as possible. Now, this is one of these kits where the teeth are molded in the front half of the figure and the back half is a big hollow. And I didn't want to just paint the inside black. I wanted to be able to see the inside of his mouth. So here's where this realism thing comes in. I took a piece of aluminum foil and formed it around the inside of that hollow mouth and stiffened it up with super glue on the inside of the piece. And then once that was good and hard, I was able to smooth the crinkly foil and the what would be the outside, the inside of the mouth, with epoxy sculpt, two-part epoxy putty. And that made it nice and smooth. So, yeah, it looks like the inside of somebody's mouth. And that gives it that little bit of dimension. And for the rest, it was just trying to paint it as naturally as I could. I came up with a technique years ago for another model I did for Modeler's Resource Magazine. And this was a 1/6 scale absorbing man. It was a resin kit. And I wanted to put body hair on him. And I tried something and it worked. I took a piece of steel wool and held it over the model with slightly thinned white glue on like the outside of the arms where I wanted the body hair to be. And then you rub the steel wool with a piece of like 60 grit sandpaper and the lint that comes down sticks on that glue in more or less random patterns. And it looks fairly much like body hair. You know, that steely gray color is pretty good just out of the off the steel wool. And then if you want to paint it or anything else, you can do that too. But it would be out of scale for a figure the size of Super Fuzz, except, you know, he's a monster anyway. So I had some on him and fairly disgusting, greasy looking guy.
I tell you, that is what attracted me to these things. And I told you earlier this week, we did a little tech check and I mentioned that these things were repulsively adorable. And the body hair all over these figures just made me crack up because it was so well done. And the overall fidelity of modeling demonstrated on these figures that almost nobody who ever built these, I've seen a few of these built up at shows from time to time, but nobody ever goes to the lengths that you did. And you really turned these things out into something amazing. The body hair, another thing that I noticed was the uses of different levels of sheen between matte and satin and gloss, depending on what surface you were trying to portray, really comes through in these things and adds a lot of realism to these really cartoonish figures.
Well, that's the fun.
What can you tell us about the really glossy? You got the glossy eyes. You've got the glossy teeth. The body looks kind of sweaty, but it's not as glossy as the eyes or the teeth. And it just all kind of worked and really, really great job. I think these things are just really brilliant.
Well, thanks. You know, the thing is that I take the same approach that somebody who's painting a model car for a show or something, and maybe they have a driver and his girlfriend or something, and you would take the same tack that you want the finish to be nice and glossy, and you want the like that club that he's holding wouldn't be glossy and things like that. And it's, you know, again, it's just to try to bring as much realism I can to these unrealistic things. For example, a lot of guys, when they build these, you have the monster is maybe grungier than hell, you know, like say Frankenstein's Flivver, but they always have the bright paint job on there. And those contrasts are just, it's funny to see them, you know?
Well, I was really impressed because again, I've seen a few of these built up. In fact, this week right now, cause I was looking at these kits, cause I think Atlantis is making them now, but there's a few of the vintage monogram ones out there available for sale obviously, but some gentleman is selling one of the Monogram factory buildups. I think it's the Surfer, Freddie Fleipauger. And I tell you, if you look at that figure unmodified with just basic paint on it, it's amazing what you did with those figures.
Well, thanks. You know, and this is the thing, is that the contrast between a cartoon character and a cartoon character that looks like it could really be alive is it's funny, and it's amusing. It's just my take. Now, I've seen like Ratfink figures done by people out in California, I guess, and they do these really wild psychedelic things, and they're gorgeous, and I wish I had that particular sensibility. Or you get somebody like Jeff Camp, who will paint a life-size bust of a universal monster in the bright colors that like Basil Gogos would apply for the cover art for an old edition of Famous Monsters of Filmland. And they're spectacular, but I haven't got that sensibility. I wish I did, but what I do is I just try, like I say, to try to make things look as realistic as possible. I'm looking at the picture in here of Speed Shift right now, and I'm sure I'd remember it if I thought about it. But he's got you can see veins in his arms, in his forearms, because people, you know, have, you can see blood vessels in them, you know, and the lips on all of these figures were just very molded, just, you know, smooth. But I could find little imperfections in the plastic so that you could exploit those and make them look cracked and, you know, kind of repulsively fleshy and it adds that dimension to it, because otherwise, yeah, you know, they're just these goofy little figures that you wouldn't pay any attention to.
Inside this particular subgenre of modeling, do you have an area that's a favorite for you? Do you prefer the classic monster models? Do you prefer the sci-fi stuff? Do you prefer the Ratfink and Freddie Fleipauger? Is there some particular area of it that you keep coming back to?
Well, probably, Dave, that would absolutely have to be the Aurora monster models. And it's not just the Universal monsters. Although, you know, you mentioned I took that collection to the 2001 Nationals, and it took first place in collections. And that was one of the biggest shocks I've ever had.
Well, it was well-deserved. Like I told you when we were talking, I remember, I have a clear memory 24 years ago or whatever of seeing that at the contest, because it wasn't something that you saw ever before of somebody really devoting that level of love and attention to those types of kits.
You know, that with collections, by the time I went to the Nationals, I had been doing pretty well by the judges, okay, at shows. And it occurred to me that to do the Aurora Monsters as a collection would be something different. And it would also mean that instead of having 8 trophies, I have 1, you know, so I'm cutting down. And it was getting to be a problem that was nice to have, but it's a problem. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to reduce the amount of table space that those 8 models would take. And that's why I put it in that, it was actually a comic book box covered with cellulite to make that rocky looking base to cut down the table space. And also I was able to label the collection. Aurora presents the Universal Monsters. So I had, you know, for the purposes of the collection, it's 8 1/8 scale Aurora models, or repops, but original Auroras, designs based only on Universal Monsters. So King Kong was out because it wasn't a universal figure. And The Bride of Frankenstein was out because it was 1/12 scale, 1/11 scale. I was able to sneak in Dr. Jekyll because on the box it was the Paramount version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but the head was clearly based in the kit on Boris Karloff as he appeared in Abbott and Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which was a Universal movie, so there you go. I'd like to do an article sometime for just on what goes into a successful collection like that, because I've seen some collections where it's like, you know, how are you calling this a collection? And I think, again, part of it is the presentation.
Right.
I did another collection of the geometric monster busts. And so they're, you know, once again, in the same genre, but a different different company. And I had 8 busts in that thing, and I had them on a custom base too. Now at that national, I took second place because first place was a set of just spectacular shadow boxes, and the guy that did them, they were all aircraft dioramas, but in shadow boxes, they were beautiful. So you know, you don't mind getting beat by that. So, and then I have a set of Haunted glow heads from the 70s. Yeah, there's something I was building in the 70s, the haunted glow heads.
That I remember those kits.
Yeah, and see, again, those are snap kits, 1/3 scale, fairly nicely detailed, but, you know, nothing spectacular. And I think I turned my nose up at most of them back in the day, but when they reissued them, I said, oh, I got to get hold of these. And I had a partially built-up vampire that I'd gotten on eBay, and I customized that into an alien, a three-eyed alien, based on the critter from Who Goes There by John W. Campbell. But that gave me 5 models then to put in another collection. And yes, I went overboard on all of those too. If you go on my website, you can see them.
Well, I wouldn't call it overboard, but you put into, and that's, I think, again, one of the things that Mike and I were both taken by in your work, is that you devote to these models a level of attention and detail that they clearly deserve, but that they rarely get because, you know, a lot of them were built by kids as kids, and they were, I don't want to say novelty items, but they were items that niche items. And, yeah. And you've taken those and you've given them the attention that they deserve. And it really makes a point as to how nicely they can be finished. They can be finished to really represent, like with the monster model, with the Universal Monster models, a really great representation of the film that they come from.
Yeah, you know, well, it's, I think it's like every single genre of modeling. You're going, it really is an interpretive art. You know, an actor doesn't usually write his own lines. He interprets them. A musician doesn't usually write their own score. They interpret them. And so a plastic modeler is an interpretive artist. And some guys will, modelers will just slap the model together. And that's kind of the way they were probably intended. And then you get some guys, and you name the category, they just do this jaw-dropping job. The guy that does the cutaways of the inside of a tank or an aircraft, you know, or the guy that does say the 350th scale aircraft carrier with every little bell and whistle and all of the photo etch, and they light it up, you know, and everything else, or the you know, you name it. And so I kind of take that sensibility, and it's because, you know, you just have a real love of the subject, and you want to do the most that you can with it. And I'm the guy that does that with these horror models, and the goofier they are, the better. You know, the bigger the challenge, the more fun it is. I've got a couple of rat finks on my workbench right now.
Now, for the monster models, again, like I said, they are great representations of the real thing from the movie.
Yeah.
When you go to build one of those, do you find yourself going back to the movie again and again to look at it, to try it, to use it as a reference?
Yes, sir, I do. The fortunate thing is that, you know, you can amass a huge collection of DVDs and run them through your computer and do screen caps and stuff. And of course, there's a lot of online material too. And there's still, some of us still read books that are made out of paper. And I use all of that stuff because I know it's, and again, it's like the aircraft builder or the ship builder or the auto builder or whatever. You want to, you have the impulse to want to get it as close to the actual thing that you're building that you can. So I did a bust for a friend of mine, Joshua Swift, who he owns Crimson Pool Productions, and he released a very nice 1/4 scale bust of James Arness as the Thing. So in researching that, I discovered that all the pictures that you see of him are from the front or maybe one side, but you never really see him from the back. And I did find one from the back, and sure enough, there was a nexus of blood vessels on the back of his head that I never knew were there. And, that's one extra step of reality that you could bring to it. The prototype that he sent me to build for his company didn't have the blood vessels on there. And when we discovered that, he had them added in the molds, and I had to fudge them with white glue. But you always learn something new, and that's one of the great things about plastic modeling is the education that you get out of it.
Well, I've got to say that is one of my favorite movies, the original, The Thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the first, third of the book maybe. And of course, they made it more or less into a standard monster format, but it's a very well done monster format. Allegedly, Howard Hawks not only produced it, but also did a lot of the directing. And regardless, it's a spooky movie in its own right. And I think too, especially with films, if you grew up with those monster movies, every time I see Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, I'm a 10-year-old again, sitting in front of the TV watching it for the first time. Not frightened, but awed, you know, because I was pretty familiar with it from reading Famous Monsters of Filmland and stuff. But it was, there's that familiarity and stuff. You just love these things, and you want to do your best with them.
Well, let's talk about the kits. We've talked about the Freddy Flypogger, and we've mentioned some of the others, like the Hawk Weirdos and the Ed Big Daddy Roth Rat Fink figures. Perusing your website, you've built quite a collection of the Aurora monsters. Do you have any desires there to locate and build as many of those as possible? And are you interested in I believe there were some Star Trek ones as well at one time, am I mistaken, or was that somebody else? What's your goal there for those old classic kits?
Yeah. First of all, I'm a styrene freak. I have some 3D printed parts in my stash, but I've got resin replacement heads and whatnot, but I've always been a styrene guy. And if you had this or that kit when you were a kid, boy, you just can't help but be drawn to it as an adult. So I have a couple of Star Trek kits. I've got a lot of things that, you know, you start, you set down, you pick them up again. And I've got anything that's off the beaten track, I guess, is the sort of thing that attracts me. And I do have some more Aurora kits. I sold the collection of Aurora monsters that I competed with at the Nationals, and they were done all pretty much out of the box. So I've been redoing them, but now they are with all of the things that you could bring to bear today. So I have a Dracula with a John Carradine replacement head and the Rick Evans Night Owl replacement base. And I've got the Frankenstein replacement base, and I'm actually going to try and do something original with him. But I did, I changed the Aurora mummy into Tom Tyler from the Mummy's Hand with a different base, and so on and so forth. You know, so this next collection is going to be still the Aurora monsters, but done well outside the box.
Let me ask about that, because I'm completely unfamiliar. So you're taking the Aurora kit, or a current incarnation of the Aurora kit, maybe molded by somebody else today, and there are aftermarket parts to accomplish what? What are you gaining from a new head or a new base?
For example, the Dracula. First of all, the replacement head is designed to fit the kit, and that takes a little engineering, because there is a collar, the wing collar and bow tie that has to slip over the neck before that neck is glued onto the body. And whoever, I'm not sure who sculpted it, they're available on escapehatchhobbies.com. And but it looks just like John Carradine as he appeared in some of the Universal Dracula films of the 40s, House of Dracula and House of Frankenstein. And then you have the rest of the kit. Then Rick Evans, he has his own little firm called Night Owl Productions, and he made a nice resin kit. It looks like the inside of a castle, not the sort of outdoor scene that comes out of the box. And it's engineered so that it fits the Dracula figure perfectly. And so that gives you a chance to build a Dracula kit, but it's different than what anybody else is going to have. And I say that knowing that you could have 100 people build the same model, and you're going to get 100 different variations. And with all of these aftermarket parts and stuff, the same modeler can build a dozen of them and still never come up with the same model. So it's truly plastic, you know, in the dictionary sense of the term, that you can just do anything with these things.
Well, I'm like Mike. I had zero clue that there was any sort of aftermarket production for all of these old monster kits, that there was actually a whole industry focused on allowing you to change and modify those original kits. That's just fantastic.
Oh, yeah. If you wanted to build a collection just of the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kit, you would start with the out-of-the-box kit. You would then do one with a John Barrymore as Mr. Hyde from the 1920s with a nameplate based on the artwork for that movie. You can get the Frederick March version with a nameplate. You can get kits that alter it to look like Basil Rathbone in Son of Frankenstein, messing with his lab equipment right before Karloff jumps on him. You can get Vincent Price in the Tingler with the big rubber centipede going up his arm. Mr. Evans makes an add-on base that puts the artwork the laboratory stuff and the box art in the scene with the figure. So those are the ones that I can think of just off the top of my head. There's probably more I've forgotten. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Frankenstein, you can get an accurate Karloff head from Brighter Frankenstein, which is what the kit represents. You can get an accurate Karloff head as he appeared in the original Frankenstein from 31. You can get a replacement head and body so that he looks like he did in Son of Frankenstein with that fur vest on. You can get one with a replacement body and head for John Chaney Jr. in Ghost of Frankenstein and Bela Lugosi in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and you can get Glenn Strange as Frankenstein. So, you know, the possibilities are very nearly endless. And that's even before you start messing with the base, you know. People will alter the base and so on. And again, like I say, Night Owl Productions has a couple of variations on the Frankenstein base. It's like you can get so many variations on an aircraft. You know, you can get different tires, different engines, different almost countless number of markings and things. Not to mention all the photo etch and resin reproductions for those. And somewhere along the line, somebody said, "Well, we can do that with aircraft and armor and cars and things. Why can't we do that with monsters?" And they have.
Well, I think that's really interesting that they're splitting down to the film and the various actors who portrayed these roles and doing it so well. That's just really fascinating. I really had no idea this rabbit hole was so deep. So I appreciate your insight into that. And it's going to make me look at these things a lot more carefully at the shows when I go to them, because just amazing.
No, well, I'm just going to say that you do see all kinds of levels of artistry with these things. And if you get to Louisville this summer, you go into Wonderfest and prepare to have your mind blown wide apart, because you'll see some things that are, you know, look like your grandson could do, and then some things that you literally do. You look at him and you go, you know, no way, you know.
I live in Louisville. I attend Wonderfest pretty much every year.
Well, I'll keep an eye out for you then.
Yes, we'll have to meet up there.
Yeah, I missed the last 2 years. One for health reasons, and one because things got, you know, when you're the happy home, when you get tied up sometimes. But I'm definitely going this year, and it's as much fun as any as a national, let's say, to go to that.
Sure.
Well, I imagine for your genre, it is. To change gears a little bit, let's talk about availability and these kits. You know, some of the Aurora kits in the original boxes can be quite collectible. I'm sure a lot of those aren't getting built. Those molds are kind of dispersed among a few current manufacturers. What can you tell us about current availability and whether or not you prefer an original molding or the current moldings holding up to the quality standards that the old ones were, or possibly they're even better? I don't know.
I'm going to say that in my experience, the reissues, you know, you might see a little extra flash on some of them over the years, but it seems like the original Aurora models, monsters, seem to get themselves reissued about once every 10 years. I mean, since 1961, there has never been an absolute dry spell of where nothing has been produced from the Aurora kits, you know. They have gone into other people's hands. I won't go into all the gory details there, but as far as an original, you know, the thing is that they are being repopped all the time. And in the late 90s and the early part of this century, you had Polar Lights come along with the technology to be able to scan an old kit that had not been built, but for which the molds had long since been destroyed. And then they use computers to cut new molds. And so you're taking the egg and making the chicken. And I remember, it was right around the turn of the century. I was in a toy store and I saw the Addams Family Haunted House. And I thought, well, this must be a puzzle based on the artwork for the box, because they're not making the model anymore. But you pick the box up and you shake it and you get that characteristic sound of plastic parts rattling around. And then I looked down and I saw the Polar Lights logo, and it's like, oh, Polar Lights, Aurora, I get it. Somebody's remaking this model. So I snapped that up, and then before you know it, I'm rebuilding my collection of Aurora models. Lately, you'll see outfits like Mobius and Atlantis, and somehow, and I have no idea how this gets done, they're able to make short runs of some of these kits that you haven't seen for a long time, and not just monster models. I think they're redoing the B-58 Hustler, and I don't know if that was an Aurora kit or a Revell, but you'll see they come and go. They're around for half a year or so, and then they disappear again. And somehow they're able to do that economically. And I don't know how. Right now they're redoing a couple more of these Flypogger kits and a couple more of the Ratfink kits. And how they can do that is beyond me, but heaven bless them for doing it. Now, I will say this. You get these guys that absolutely insist on having an original kit. And every once in a while the Parts Pit vintage model parts Facebook page, somebody will post and say, I need the right hand of the mummy, and it's got to be the original part. I don't want a repop. Now, I remember that the original mummy was like cast in off white, but if I needed a part for a mummy I was working on, it was one of the pink luminators things, I wouldn't care, because under paint it's going to look like the original part. So, but I suppose there are collectors that they must have only the original and nothing else will do, and that's fine. But I'm a bottom feeder. I was just asked to build an Aurora Gladiator from 1964. It's mint in the box. The only thing that's missing was the plastic bags and the wrap on the outside. And I know that it'll horrify some people to hear that I'm going to subject it to glue and paint, but that's what the guy that asked me to build it wanted, and I'm happy to do it for him. So there you go.
And that's what the kit was intended to be done with when it was made.
Absolutely. And that's my intention. Now, I understand that people want to collect things and stuff. And I do have a collection of unbuilt models, just because they were models I built for Polar Lights. And I wanted to have them with the original box art and stuff, because the model I built for them is on the back of the box, and it just it's a vanity thing. Yes. But I will probably never build them, because part of the deal when I was putting those models together was that they'd send me a bag kit too, so I can build those. But I have the mint box kit so that I can say, oh, look at this one.
So you're doing some consignment work, and did I hear correctly that you've built some for the manufacturers as well?
Yes, sir. I did. I guess six. Let's see, about 10 kits for Polar Lights. And then Joshua Swift, who's also a personal friend, always has me build, not so much build, but paint his bust. These are beautiful busts. And he really looks for a niche within a niche. His first five were a set of horror figures from silent films. And not the Hunchback of Notre Dame, not the Phantom of the Opera. It was the Golem from the 1920 German film. And villain in The Cat and the Canary has his bizarre disguise on. Oh, Boris Karloff in The Bells. And it's a beautiful rendering. They're all sculpted by Ray Santillari, who's one of the giants in the industry. And the Karloff thing is just absolutely chilling, if you've seen the bells. And otherwise, it's just a really good Karloff bust.
Well, what are you working on now?
For myself, I'm finishing up the Munsters living room from the 1999 reissue by Polar Lights. And again, you know, I'm one for, I can't just build out of the box anymore. So I've expanded the wall behind them and the base, the floor base, and done everything I could to make the figures more realistic. And I've added a back to the wall because I hated those, the vertical sections of any Aurora kit where the back was just the inside of the part. And they did nothing to make the back of the model look like the front of the model, you know, with all that detail. So I've added this extra back wall. And then there's a gentleman named Ed Bauckley, and he used to do Dice Man creations. And he had a scale Marilyn figure to go with the model. And it was the last of the runs before the moles completely gave out on him. So it needed a lot of work, but I finally got her done so that I have Marilyn to add for this too. And because I expanded the floor, there's room to move everybody out away from the back of the wall a little bit and stuff. And I'm trying something I've never done before. There's a fireplace, a couple of candles on the mantle, and a television set. And they're all light sources. Now, traditionally, I would have tried to maybe recast the fireplace in clear plastic, clear resin, so that I could have it lit with flickering LEDs. And I'd put a blue light in the TV screen and maybe even run some fiber optics up into those candles to make them light up. But the thing is, when you're at a show, 9 times out of 10, the room light just drowns all of that out. So there's a gentleman whose work I've seen on the internet who paints light effects on his models. And I said, well, by George, if he can do it, I'm going to give it a try. And so far, it's coming out pretty well. And the nice thing about that is, unless the room is pitch dark, you'll be able to see these effects of illumination, but it's all done with paint. And then I have, for Mike Blanchard, I'm doing, I've got two more Rat Fink kits, Boss Fink and Robin Hood Fink, that are reissued by Atlantis. Boss Fink is very nearly done, and I've just started on Robin Hood Fink, and then this Gladiator for this this other gentleman. So there's always plenty of stuff piled up on my workbench.
This has been really wonderful. I've really enjoyed this. It's given me an insight into an area that I was completely blind to, and there's nothing more enjoyable than talking with a modeler about his craft, and particularly if it's an area that I'm not familiar with. You clearly have a love for this this genre, and it shines through, and it's been really enjoyable.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. And you know, again, I list myself as being a big of enthusiast as the guy who builds whatever they build, you know. That's one of the great things about IPMS and being able to go to the shows and so on, so that you can talk to other people and, you know, have all that cross-fertilization and things. Maybe you're inspired by somebody else. Maybe you inspire someone. And to be able to share all this takes that hobby out of the basement, you know, and out in the real world. Because I think, like I say, we're all artists, and you all want to see your work and have your work, see other people's work and have your work be seen.
Well, speaking of shows, I know we were both at Columbus last weekend, and somehow we missed you. We were away from the table shopping, spending money we probably didn't need to spend. Hopefully we'll catch up with you soon, maybe at Wonderfest if that's a regular for you, because that's right in our backyard, literally in Dave's backyard. Sure. I'm about an hour away. Well, hopefully we can see more of your work there. And well, Mark, I want to thank you for taking time to join us on Plastic Model Mojo.
Well, it's been an honor.
Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And I tell you, it's for March. Typically, I've always felt, and it's not just me, spring always has elements of renewal, whether it's the Easter story or whatever, and newness and new life and all that. And March for Plastic Model Mojo is going to be a couple of subjects. Your Monster Builds is one. And then we've got Real Space coming up again later in the month. Two genres that don't get a lot of love in the greater hobby press or what have you. And we thought we'd want to touch on those. And we appreciate you sharing some insight into this genre, because we've only seen it from the spectator side. It's nice to see what you got going on. And again, the Freddy Flypoggers that were in the IPMS Journal were absolutely outstanding. I would have never thought that level would have even, I don't want to say I wouldn't think it would be possible, but I'm just incredibly impressed that you took the time to put that kind of effort into those kind of kits, because that is something that's really fresh for me and was previously unknown.
Well, I appreciate your attitude, because I remember seeing in Fine Scale Modeler years ago, a letter where somebody wrote in and said, why are these guys building models of weird figures and spaceships and so on? You should only be building models of real things. And well, you understand that what an idiotic attitude that is. And I'm not a particularly enthusiastic aircraft or car or auto builder or armor builder. But at the same time, I appreciate what it takes to do those. And, you know, periodically, if I'm at a show and I'm helping to judge and I can't judge in figures or something else, so they need a body elsewhere, then I'll go and help judge some of these other categories. And, you know, you learn real fast what it takes to turn out, like, say, a decent car. These guys that can get those mirror-like finishes on there just floor me. And doing these Rat Fink figures right now, they are fantastic characters that are set in the Revell Ed Big Daddy Roth car kits. And boy, you try to put one of those together after you're used to 1/8 scale head halves and trying to stick the 1/25th scale water hose between the radiator and the engine block without getting any glue on the chrome. And it's like, oh man, that's a whole nother ball game. So I've come to really respect what other people do. And I appreciate that other people respect what I do and the people like me do. And, you know, Real Space, that's a whole nother fun thing. And again, you know, it's, there's a lot of history automatically locked into that.
Well, Mark, I appreciate you comment on my attitude, and that's just kind of the way we do it here at Plastic Model Mojo. If it makes us smile, it's good. So we appreciate what you're doing, and again, we thank you for joining us on the show, and look forward to seeing your work up close and personal when you can sit there and tell us about it face to face.
We'll look for you at Wonderfest.
That's a date, fellas. I'll have a bottle of bourbon in the room.
Oh, you got it.
All right.
Well, I know I get you.
That's right.
Thanks again. I really appreciate you having me on.
You're welcome. You. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. See you around.
All right. You. Take care.
Well, Dave, that's some interesting stuff.
Yes, absolutely. I had almost zero knowledge of any of that, including the fact that there's a whole aftermarket industry. Just blows me away. I can't wait to see Mark at Wonderfest this year, and I'm sure going to spend more time at Wonderfest paying attention to the models in that genre.
I think you're going to end up going down a rabbit hole, Dave.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
I guess we shouldn't have been surprised with the aftermarket side of that, but you know, I guess in all honesty, we'd not given it much thought.
Right, exactly.
Up or down, right or wrong, we just haven't, because we got our own little corner of the modeling world we're in, and that's just the way it is. But really interesting, and I was really impressed by those builds that were in the journal. And if you get on his website, and we'll put that link in the show notes, you can see a whole bunch more of his work, and it's all just really well done.
Yes.
All right, Dave, it's the Benchtop Halftime Report, and this is brought to us by Squadron Hobbies. Squadron Hobbies, adding to your stash since 1968, Dave.
Yep.
So, folks, give Brandon and the folks over at Squadron a look and see what they've got going on, and I'm sure he's going to have something to add to your stash.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Hopefully, we've been whittling away at the stash, even if it's just a little bit, Dave.
Yep.
What's on your bench?
Well, lots of things are on my bench, but I have focused on the LCM-3. It is now to the point where I've got to add the machine guns and machine gun shields and stanchions. I've got to make and paint the make the masks and paint the markings, which are very simple. This thing is within a long weekend of being finished. And so I've put everything else to the side. I am laser focused on this, and it's going to be done for HeritageCon. I promise all of you listening, you will see this at HeritageCon.
Now, we had a listener warn you about doing this.
Well, it's going to. I'm telling you. It's going to be there along with one or two other things, possibly. We'll see.
Okay. Well, been working on anything else?
Mainly, I'm focused on that. I'm still trying to rearrange my model room. I'm about halfway through it. I'm making improvements. It's making the modeling space more livable and more user-friendly. So that's about it from my benchtop, but things are moving.
Let's back up and talk about the landing craft a little bit more. What are you actually working on at the moment?
Okay, well, I just completed the weathering, the pin washing, the basic weathering. Now, the only thing that I left off, and it's because they are mostly made up of photo etch, is the stanchions, gun shields, and 50 cals that get mounted on the boat. They're all assembled. Well, they're in two or three pieces, but they're all ready to be painted, then mounted onto the boat itself. At that point, everything gets a satin cut. Well, no, the stencils get cut, the very simple markings get painted, then everything gets a satin coat, and there's some weathering I'm gonna do. Additionally, you know, some saltwater marks, some other stuff, but generally it's going to be done, and then I can leisurely do additional things as we get toward HeritageCon. But yeah, I like it. It's not perfect, and that bothers me, but it's always going to bother me because I'm never going to build the perfect model. But there's something to getting something done, even though you know it's not going to be quite as good as you would like it to be. It's still going to be a good model, and we'll see. But it will be there at HeritageCon. I promise every one of you.
Heard it here first, folks.
Yes, that's right. How about you, Mike? What's well, I know what your benchtop's been like because you've been posting photos left and right in the dojo, man.
I have all the gray bottom side color on the E16.
Yep. And it looked beautiful.
Yeah, that came out pretty good. I'm pleased with that.
Yeah.
Had a little bit of negative modeling when I say I'm done with it. I got a little touch up to do. Not much. Not right. Much. I don't even know if I can put that little paint in my airbrush, but I'm going to have to. Somewhere along the line, I don't know if I bumped it or held it in a certain way, but
Well, and sometimes they just seams just split.
Yeah, I mean, so
sometimes
the,
they just do.
The leading edge seam on the starboard wing split between the wing root and the float strut, the forward one. And I just had to put some extra thin back on there, let that dry for about a day. Then I came back with the Tamiya putty, put that on in the morning before work, came back home that evening, and it wasn't very much. So I was confident it was probably pretty dry. So I've sanded that out now and got it all smooth again. So I need to go back and touch up just a little bit of the underside color right there. But other than that, it's going to be on to the green. And I'm going to use decals for the national markings. I'm actually going to mask the spot for that because the green on the tail of the fuselage tail,
yep,
kind of wraps around the Hinamaru.
Yep.
And I want to get a good demarcation there just in case the decal isn't like completely opaque.
Yep. And that is a danger sometimes with Japanese.
So I don't want to have markings. This dark red where I decaled over green and then
right.
a lighter shade or a hue shift from decaling over the light gray. So
yep.
that's the plan for that. You know, it's going pretty well. I like the way the underpainting shows through the gray. It's going to be a little bit of a challenge to kind of keep that with the green. I'm going to see how thin I can spray that green. I don't know. We'll see.
I have faith.
Well, other than that, I've spent most of the time, well, since the Musaru's in the rearview mirror, working on the base for the KV-85, my Soviet tank I'm working on.
Right.
To rewind a little bit, I'm having to get the base done to a certain point so I can pose the suspension on the tank.
Right.
Because the tracks are glued down and scenery has to happen in a certain sequence. The railroad tracks and ties really needed to be completely painted and finished before I move forward. Because I have to put the ballast down between the rails.
Right.
And I don't see any way to paint the things once that's done. And haven't looked the way I wanted anyway.
Right.
So I've been painting railroad ties. You know, I posted on the dojo, probably, I don't know if it was end of December, early January. I painted those test pieces.
Yep.
Did some experimentation, found something that I worked, and I made some good notes. Then I came back to it, and I didn't get it exactly the same, but actually what I got, I like a little better than the test pieces. So it all worked out. I think I got a good technique. I think I enhanced the wood grain and weather beaten looks of those ties beyond the actual molded in texture that's on them. And then once I got the ties done, I went back and I masked it all off and I airbrushed the rails and the tie plates with a really dark, dark brown rust color, one of the Life Color rust series, the rust dark shadow color. That's what I started with.
Yep.
Then that was kind of a different sequence that I'd used on my test rails because I actually started using some glazes and washes on a dark gray base coat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I airbrush these ties or these rails and tie plates straight up with that color, I'm kind of starting from a different point. I'm starting from a brown instead of a gray. So I had to go back and kind of revisit how I'd done that and come up with a new way. And I think I've got it. So hopefully this weekend, the rails are going to get done. And the tie plates and all that. So
now, and what you're trying to reproduce is not a running rail line, but a rail line that's kind of been abandoned and sitting unused.
It got abandoned. Maybe it was a route that ran north south,
right,
in Ukraine before the war, and then since the invasion, it's fallen out of use. So it's going to be rusted rails. It's going to be overgrown. To some degree, a little bit.
Right. The ties are going to be older and weathered.
Yeah. Not like completely decrepit, but certainly not in service. That's kind of what I'm after.
Gotcha.
And I found some good photos on the internet that are helping me get that the way I want it to be. So it's been a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun doing those ties last weekend. It just, once I got into the zone, man, it just went a lot faster than I ever thought it would. I thought I'd signed up for some arduous and long sessions of not getting, but maybe one or two done at a time. But once I got the technique down, it actually didn't take as long as I thought it would.
Yeah, that happens a lot of times. Your anticipation of the work makes it much bigger in your head than it actually turns out to be.
Well, that's it, man. That's all I've been working on, I believe. I've been kicking around some other project ideas. I'm itching to start something now that I got the Moosaroo Cup done.
Yep.
Got a couple things. Maybe something I picked up at Columbus. Maybe a magnum opus. I don't know. Maybe both.
You've got irons in the fire, man. Irons in the fire. And nothing gets your juices up like finishing something. You finished that Moosaroo and it got you moving.
It did.
It's a modeling laxative. Mike, lots of new stuff coming out.
There is.
Lots of new stuff coming out. Amazing amount of new stuff coming out. I assume you've been paying attention.
I have.
I assume you've made notes of a few things.
You would be correct.
And I've got a number of faves. So how about you? Faves and yawns.
My first is a fave. A curiosity. I have a lot of those, don't I?
Yeah.
I'm kind of a wait and see, unless I know the manufacturer.
Sure.
It's kind of a wait and see.
Well, that's smart.
It gets my attention. So the first one that's gotten my attention, and folks, if anybody knows the skinny on this kit, hop on the dojo and let us know or email the show. I'm real curious. The maker is a company called War Slug. It is a 35th scale T3485 from factory 183. About spring 1945, full interior kit. This kit has a metal gun barrel, at least one piece of ammunition that's metal. It says metal bullet on the box. So that's
let's hope it's not a real bullet.
Lost in translation. It's got PE and clear parts, workable tracks and workable suspension, 3D printed parts, resin parts, magnetic parts, and a workable gun. I don't know if that means the coaxial machine gun can be positioned or the main gun recoils or something, or goes up and down, I guess, maybe.
Maybe.
I'm real curious because based on the menu there, it's all that and a bag of chips. But is it any good? I don't know.
Yeah. So anybody out there who's seen this kit in the flesh, please reach out on the dojo or email and let us know.
Real curious. It also comes with a book. What more could you want, man?
Exactly.
It could be terrible, though. I don't
know. Oh, it could be. And that's the problem is you never know. You want to wait and see a couple of people who've had it in their hands.
Yeah. Well, that's my first one. What do you got?
Well, mine is to a manufacturer, and that is Dead Design Models.
Oh, yeah. They went nuts, didn't they?
They have gone nuts, and they've done something that I think is genius. They are marketing together vacuform canopies and canopy masks for their vacuform canopies together as one item for just got almost any model out there that you can think of. It is a just an amazing thing, from jets to a lot of Japanese World War II, of course, which is where they got started. But it just, to me, that was a genius move to say, you know, we're not going to sell you a canopy and then sell you a canopy mask set that may or may not fit the vac form because it was made to fit the prototype item in the kit. So they are packaging together a vac form canopy and a mask set for that canopy. And I just think that's genius. Hats off, Dead Design.
Well, my next one's interesting, and it's an STL file. It's done by Jackson Stanton. You know Jackson. We've met him at his shows. He's part of the Plastic Posse Expanded Universe.
I love that Expanded Universe.
He has spent a lot of time developing a really good CAD model and STL set for wading trunks for one of the Tasca 35th scale Sherman kits.
Cool.
And that's one version. That one, a vehicle carrying those, and then also the Firefly version are two versions of Sherman that are kind of high on my interest list for Shermans. I'm gonna talk to Jackson first because I got a couple questions, but they look really good, and the STL files aren't that expensive, and I'm probably going to pick those up and give those a print a print whirl and see what that looks like. But they look really sharp.
Well, that sounds great. Well, my next fave is a double fave, and it is a nod to our next episode, which is focused on real space. Bronco has released a 72nd scale kit of a Chinese Shenzhen 1D space launch vehicle. And our friends down under at Horizon have announced an Atlas Agena rocket. And I remember the Atlas Agena was probably the first U.S. rocket and program that I actually remember as a kid. I'm all for real space, more all for real space in God's one true scale, 72nd scale. And I'm going to be picking up both of these ASAP.
Well, at least you're not doing like the OTB guys and talking about the dong.
That's right. Hey, I built the dong.
Let's not go there, man.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, my next one will put some folks in a moral dilemma, I guess.
Okay.
Zvezda is releasing their version of the B-4 tracked howitzer from World War II. Now, Trumpeter has a kit. I'm curious how this one's going to compare, but that's the BFG, man.
Yep.
And
that's just cool looking.
And I wanted the one way back in the day. You know, we're talking about old aftermarket resin crap a lot on this episode. And Mike Bishop, MB Models, did one ages ago. And then there was a company called Miniature Model out of Romania.
Yep.
Ploiești, in fact. Had a resin kit, which I have. I bought that at Amps years ago. And then I've never picked up the Trumpeter kit, but up at Columbus.
You almost did last in Columbus.
I picked up a barrel for one.
Right. But you had that kit in your hands.
I did, but I spent my limit already, man. So we'll see what they do with the gun. I don't know. It's an interesting piece.
Yes.
Some other things have been happening behind the scenes. They'll get talked about in the What Broke My Wallet in the next episode. But this is a project that may go up in urgency. So I probably need to be looking for that Trumpeter kit.
Yeah.
But it was just interesting because the Trumpeter one's been out a while. And I believe it has lineage to the Pit Road.
Yes.
That was a white metal kit.
Right.
And then I think they... I don't know if there's a partnership because there's a Pit Road plastic one too, but it's the same kit as the Trumpeter, I'm pretty sure. But we'll see. The neat thing.
You'll be looking for one at HeritageCon.
I will.
And you can pay those cheap Canadian prices.
I have to put my feelers out and see if somebody can find one for me.
Yep.
What you got next?
The next one's another fave. This is a fave episode. Company called A&A Models has announced a Basler BT-67, which, for those of you who know, it's a DC-3 with turboprop engines, an extended fuselage, and a modified tail and wingtips. It's just way cool. The DC-3 is cool. The C-47 is cool. And these things are still in use today, where they took old DC frames that are just so well built that they're durable 60, 70 years later, and grafted all these changes onto them, and they turn out to be great bush / rough field / aircraft to be used in places where a more modern aircraft simply couldn't go. And I've always thought this thing was cool. And I've wondered why it took us this long to get a kit. And yeah, I can see myself buying one of these too, man. My wallet's going to hurt.
Well, those are my three, man. That's all I got. What else?
Well, I got one more.
All right, we'll go for it.
IBG at the beginning of February announced the IAR 8081 series of aircraft, the Romanian aircraft that were developed from the Polish PZL 24 series. but made into a low-wing monoplane. And these, the IAR 8081 has been kitted short run by four or five manufacturers. And I guarantee you, I have every one of these kits. And they're all short run, and none of them have been up to a standard where I looked at it and go, okay, I want to invest the time in making this right, because I love the aircraft. It just is a very attractive aircraft. And I know IBG, their 190D series is flat out amazing. A lot of their aircraft kits are amazing, so I have no doubt this is going to be major manufacturer, beautifully done kit, and I'm going to buy the heck out of them. I will, and, you know, I can't wait.
And you got to have a fire sale on the other ones.
Yeah, well, that's right. The other ones, I don't know what I'm going to do with. I almost feel bad pawning them off on somebody else. So we'll see. Well, Mike, we're almost at the end of the episode, and I'm almost at the end of my beer. Hop Avenger, I can tell you, is really, really good. Even though it's advertised as Hop Avenger IPA, and so, you know, you might worry that they're going to go over the top. They don't. It's good. It's in the same class as Gumball Head. Now, it doesn't live up to Gumball Head, but it's a really good beer, and I really enjoyed it. How about you?
I'm glad I saved one pour of the Pursuit Bourbon, because I'm going to miss it, Dave.
You need to add that to your Christmas or birthday list so that that the wife and kids may get some for you.
That'd be a good gift.
Yep.
You know, I might splurge at Nat's and bring a bottle.
Oh, that would be good.
But it's a blend. It's good. They picked all the right stuff and put in the right amounts. And it's sublime, man. And I'm going to have to.
Clearly, that's an art form, that where they're taking other people's bourbons and blending them together to make something new and different.
Well, hopefully they'll be doing their own here shortly.
Well, I can't wait.
That's their goal.
Mike, we're truly at the end of the episode now. Do you have some shout outs?
I've got one.
I've got three.
Would you go first with one of yours?
Well, one of mine is to all the dojo members out there. We're almost at 4,000 members. The amount of participation has gone through the roof. As I said earlier, commenting on the modeling video discussions, the level of thoughtfulness and participation in goodwill that is been demonstrated by dojo members, it just blows me away. We got the greatest group of listeners out there, and guys, I'm in awe. So thank you to the dojo members.
Well, I want to thank Inch High Guy, Jeff Groves. He brought me a big stack of books about Pennsylvania and the Arizona. And
a bunch of decals.
And a bunch of decals. Yeah, he brought me some Tech Mod decals for the Hinamarus and some Japanese tail codes. Look forward to using that. He even gave me a couple of books.
I know.
A couple of them don't have to go back.
The man is generous beyond belief.
Well, we made a promise to get him on the show, so we're going to have him on, hopefully,
yes,
here sooner, not later this year, and talk about batch builds and 72nd scale.
Yep.
Well, what's your next one, Dave?
My next one is to all of our Patreon and PayPal contributors. Guys, I really appreciate the faith, the love that you all have shown for the podcast. Mike and I are really, in 2024, planning to do a lot, upgrades to software, upgrades to equipment, and none of this would be possible without the folks out there who've shown a love and a belief in the podcast. And I just want to express to each and every one of you my heartfelt thanks.
Well, I'll pile on a little bit.
Okay.
And let folks know that if they would like to contribute to the show, you can do that in several ways. And the best way to find those avenues for supporting the show is just to go to www.plasticmodelmojo.com and just open up the latest episode. And in the show notes, there will be links to all the avenues of support for the show. And we really appreciate it. And you guys make it worthwhile and a lot of fun for us. So thank you very much.
And finally, I want to give an anticipatory shout out to our Canadian friends. Hamilton's coming up, HeritageCon. I can't wait. I will tell you the anticipation of this is second only to the anticipation of the Nationals for me. And in some ways, HeritageCon is even more special. And it would not be possible without our friends from the Great White North, particularly Evan, Chris Wallace, and Ian, and the guys at HeritageCon themselves. When we went up last year, I was blown away by the hospitality we were shown by those folks. And again, it adds to the anticipation. I cannot wait. I'm crawling out of my skin. We're waiting to go.
Well, Dave, we are at the end of this.
Yes, we are.
And as we always say,
so many kits,
so little time, Dave.
See you soon.
We'll see you soon. We got some stuff to swap.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to set that up, man.
You got it.
All right. Take it easy.